total number of unique payments, so how many folks were in pay for one, you know, either phase one, two, or outcome status, was a little over 30%, if I've done my math right, because 124 were in pay. Total number of folks we had in outcome payment status and not receiving benefits was 37. And again, if you can't see that, you have to scroll down a little bit. And there's approximately 8 more that we're expecting this month, in fact, to achieve outcome status. We can go to the next slide. So this slide shows us and provides us a reminder on the return on investment. Of course, this is a generalization. We know that not everyone will remain completely off benefits, but I hope this information in this slide provides you with clear and convincing reasons why you should partner and engage with the Public Workforce Development System and your local job center, even if they are an EN and you're an EN. There's ways to do that effectively, too. So let's look at a few more pieces here of our New York puzzle. That number I gave you, 37 out of the total number we had, was about over 9% that are off benefits. So if those folks did remain off, we know that in the past the GAO has done some research and provided reports that show, and I might be off there, I think it's anywhere from 240, I think I've read, to 300,000 that can be saved in taxpayer dollars for each beneficiary we help remove from the benefits rolls. Again, we know they won't all stay there. But since our grant was, actually it was a little less than $5 million for this state project, if just 17 of those folks were to stay off, we'd have had the equivalent in savings, of course, if they do stay off. Based on the numbers I provided, we had 37 folks off benefits, which could achieve, could reach that $11 million figure, which is astounding to me. Now, it probably, in all reality, won't, but we wanted you to see that this is where that's at. And the next slide, please. Great. This slide shows the data from Iowa. Now, each state collects data differently, so this is going to look a little different than what I just showed you for New York, but it's still compelling. This is another state that was previously involved with the DPN initiative and is a current DEI state project. Based on the foundation they developed under DPN, Iowa's state model had a solid platform to expand their EN operations under DEI. You can see the number of payments made to this state project is 450 combined there, with a milestone outcome ratio of about 40% to 60%, which is outstanding. And there's a note there that they're a round 3 DEI state project funded in 2012, and I already mentioned they are a former recipient of the DPN initiative funding. So I hope these examples provide you a bit more context as to the capacity of our job centers today and why they're important partners as you seek to expand opportunities for employment with federal contractors for the ticket holders you serve. Next slide, please. A few final next steps that I would consider, or we would like you to consider. So I can't say it enough, I guess. Research the history of your AJC's involvement with previous and current grants that focus on services to customers with disabilities. Discover who the manager is and the WIB director. And if they have an EN operation, and some will and some won't, who might the EN coordinator be, if applicable? And schedule some time to meet with these folks. And I would make that your first step before the BSR. Understand the ability of your EN to provide qualified job seekers. So what is your capacity? So if you get this set up, can you feed folks to the leads that come through? So I think you should be prepared to address that in this meeting. And finally, with the AJC Business Services team, and this will be after you meet with the director or the AJC manager, then you should develop a process for accessing the job leads from federal contractors that the BSR is certainly going to have, that's going to meet the needs of all parties involved. Next slide, please. And lastly, I wanted to leave you with some additional resources. We talked a lot about research. Well, I'm making it a little easier for you. Here's some links where you can check in on the Disability Program Navigator Initiative, what was done under that, or if you want to research the DEI, which is current. there's a link there for more information about DEI. And lastly, there's a link here that it provided you to learn more about education and training options available through America's Job Centers. The next slide is simply my contact information. If there are questions, feel free to get a hold of me. I'm going to turn this back to Darren now.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you very much for that informative presentation on our American Job Centers and our workforce employment networks. It is now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Ms. Susan Webb. Susan?
Hi. Thanks, Darren, and thanks, Kevin, for that. I'm going to talk today about an issue that has arisen from employment networks, VR agencies, and pretty much everybody who is involved with employment of people with disabilities, and that has to do with the issue of whether to disclose disability. And I think generally we all agree that it really is something we encourage people not to do. It's not typically relevant to the job. If it is, we know how to handle that, but generally with our ticket users, the need to disclose is not there, and we advise them not to. Well, now comes along this new opportunity, and we have these new rules that do require disclosure. So how are we going to handle that? Today's learning objectives will be to understand the disability disclosure provisions of these new rules, and then to be aware of how ENs fit into the outreach requirements that federal contractors have under these new rules. Next slide. Now, this link here on the screen that you see to go to the rules, I don't think that one works. If that one works for you, great. But you'll see in parentheses there, subsection 60-741, to get to the definitions of disability as it relates to disclosure. But here's one that you can go to that for sure is going to work. If you just go to your browser and put in 41 CFR, which is the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 60-741, that will take you to the actual rules themselves. It'll take you to two different, well, there's a whole list of them. You know how it is when you go through a browser, but there's two specific ones there that can easily take you directly to the actual rules themselves, so I recommend you do that. Now, in the first training that we did, we explained that the new rules require contractors to hire people with disabilities, but this is the first time they've had what's called a utilization goal of 7%. They've always had an affirmative action obligation for a number of years, but now they have to really in earnest look at this from a numbers perspective. And that means that they might, and what's also different is that this time they must invite self-disclosure pre-employment, and that's a biggie for us in concerns about discrimination. So I'm going to address those things, but let me also say that there are some pretty good safeguards in these rules that I think are particularly good so that we can feel comfortable referring our candidates to the federal contractors, ensuring that they are going to be considered fairly according to their abilities and not their disabilities. So I'm pretty excited about this, but I do know that this is a great concern for us, so we wanted to make sure that we give you the information to make you feel comfortable with it. So they're required to invite self-disclosure pre-offer, post-offer, but also they're required to, within a year of these rules being effective, if they haven't already done it, then they have to ask their incumbent employees to also identify. And I'm going to talk in the next slide. Don't go there yet, Darren. But I will talk to you about how that works and what a concern that was brought up on the last training session that I want to address. First of all, the rule is very specific about language that all federal contractors must use in every one of these invitations to self-identify as to what disability really is, and that it is clearly stated that it's voluntary for anyone to disclose. That's really important, and because we know in the past, even though they've had an affirmative action obligation, if you've gone into some of these applications that you've seen online that when you're working with your ticket users, you see all kinds of really wild stuff. Sometimes they don't even mention that it's voluntary. Sometimes the language that they use is so off base. And the other thing, of course, that happened is the passage of the ADA Amendments Act, which took us back to the original intent of the ADA in terms of a very broad definition. So now what is going to happen, and it's not published yet, so we don't know the actual language, but when that language is published, it will be very comprehensive, very specific, and all contractors must use that language verbatim. Now, what I was going to say is that if you go to that section and look at the rules, it doesn't, the final rule itself doesn't give you all the preamble language that comes out when the regs are first published. And what I wanted to say was, if you all are interested in the preamble language about self-disclosure, I'd be happy to give it to you. If you want to email me at susanw@abil.org, A-B-I-L.org. I know that's here in a couple of places, but in case you're not going to go to the website and look for it later. And I will be happy to email you the actual preamble, because what that does is it explains to you the comments that were received about self-disclosure, how the OFCCP looked at it, and how what their rationale was for the final rule. It's very enlightening, and I think it'll make you feel pretty comfortable. Next slide, Darren. Now, here are some of the provisions. These aren't particularly new, but they're good provisions to go over, and that is that an employer can ask if a disability exists, but not what it is. There was a proposal in the original notice of proposed rulemaking suggesting that there would be a division of the types of disabilities that employers would be obligated to cover. And many of us commented and say, no, we're not going to do that. And they agreed. So the final rule does not have anything in it about requiring them to ask what a disability is. And, of course, we don't want that to happen anyway. So they cannot ask what it is, only whether there is a disability. And they must keep the disclosure in a separate file. In the rule, you'll see these used pretty much interchangeably. They'll talk about personnel files, and they even mention medical files. I'm not sure employers really have medical files so much, but it is in there. If you see it, don't let it throw you. But they really are saying it has to be kept in a separate data file and not in the personnel file, another way of protecting confidentiality from the people that are actually going to be working with the individual, with the ticket user. Now, here's another piece that's written right into the rule, and this is a little fuzzy for me. It says specifically that an employer may not compel or coerce an individual to self-identify. In the next slide, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more, because this was the question that came up on the last training in terms of whether employers are going to go out to their existing employees and strong-arm people, if you will. It's probably not a good term to use, but to suggest strongly that people identify in their current workforce as a means of not having to hire new people with disabilities and just basically look at their, and I'm sure it's probably legit that some of their employees that they have now do have a disability and will self-disclose, and that's appropriate. There's nothing wrong with that. But the point is that the rule is very specific that they may not compel or coerce, but it's not real clear on what exactly that means. So that's a question that's on the table for me, and I'm hoping that somewhere along the line we can get some additional guidance from OFCCP on that. Now, we're going to have a Q&A session at the end, and if there's anyone out there that has experience with how OFCCP handles that now under the old rules, please feel free to bring that forward, because I think that we would all gain from that. Next slide. Okay, now, the ADA Amendments Act, as I mentioned, returned the definition to a broader function-based criteria. So consequently, it really is easier for people to identify as having a disability because it's such a broad definition. Employers cannot ask for proof. Now, in the preamble, if you ask me for that language, you'll see that this was a real concern, that the pre-offer part in particular, that if employers can't really ask what the disability is, they can't really ask for proof that it even exists, Does it put them in a liability position? And so there was a lot of concern about that. But the language being in the and when I talk a little later about the affirmative action plan, you'll see how this fits in. But the language that OFCCP, or the the Department of Labor, it is OFCCP, the language that they're going to post on their website that must be used in the affirmative action plan, I think that that'll go a long way of protecting employers and making it easier for employees to know whether they do in fact qualify. But it does, of course, leave it wide open for a lot of interpretation because it is such a broad definition. So the question that came up that was so important on the last call was, how can we avoid people claiming to have a disability when they really don't have one? So that was a really tough question, and I don't think we have an answer to it. And I think in the discussion section, if anybody has any thoughts about that, it would be very helpful to discuss that. But with a broad definition, it is very possible, and then there is potentially, employers could conceivably offer a perk to identify a disability, such as a gift card, for example. Is that considered coercing or not? And so that's a question that I would have for OFCCP as we go along. And again, this goes back to how does the OFCCP deal with this now under the existing affirmative action program? How do they make sure that the people that identify really do have them and that employers aren't really encouraging people to identify that don't have a disability? I think you can see the problem with that. So I wanted to address that specifically in this training because it was something that did come up on the last training. And I thought it was a really, really good question. Next slide. Now, there is a requirement, of course, that they have an affirmative action plan. And there has to be a very strong policy statement with regard to their obligations to hire and retain and train and promote people with disabilities. And they must, this is, I think, important, they must post it and designate a specific person as the contact. Again, I think this goes to the heart of protecting disclosure, because if there is a specific person designated that is not a person that the employee would typically be working for or with, then it's another way for an employee or an applicant or anybody who self-discloses to be assured that their information will not be going to people that shouldn't have it. And the policy statement shall state that the contractor will recruit, hire, train, and promote persons with disabilities in all job titles. That's a new part of this. It's not just 7% in their entire workplace. It's 7% in each job title with some exceptions. This is going to be tough, I think, but it is part of the rule in order to prevent segregation. We all know we've seen some of the old practices of hiring people with specific types of disabilities to work in a particular location away from everyone else. These rules are very specific about the need for integration of people with disabilities in all jobs, and so that's very strongly worded in there, which I think is a good thing. They must assure that the policy statement indicates that personnel actions are administered without regard to disability and that the employment decisions they make are based only on valid job requirements. Again, this goes back to the old days when the ADA first came out, where everybody was rewriting their job descriptions to accommodate for disabilities. And that's a good thing, but employment decisions have to be based on valid job requirements, and not sticking stuff in there that may intend to screen out people with disabilities who could otherwise do the job. Next slide, please. There is a requirement for a personnel process review to ensure careful consideration of the qualifications of applicants and employees. They must schedule regular reviews and updates of their job descriptions and personnel practices. They can't put things into place and leave them there for 20 years. They have to be sure that the physical and mental qualifications shall not have the effect of screening out persons with disabilities. Again, in the preamble where they explain a lot of their intent, that's pretty good reading on this and what the intent of the regulations are. Next slide, please. This is a change from the old rules. There was a requirement in the old rules that contractors establish linkage agreements with specific entities, and VR and the One-Stops or the American Job Centers were required to have these linkage agreements. Those are no longer required. And the argument that contractors made, I think, makes sense, and that is that they would have to, in some cases, have hundreds of these things, especially a national company that has locations all over the place, all over the country, all over the world. They would be establishing these linkage agreements all over. But you'll see when I talk a little bit more about the outreach that the linkage agreements really aren't all that big a deal, because there are some other things that are required for them to do that I think negates this. Now, one of the things that Kevin talked, there, in the old rules, contractors were required to post their jobs in the American Job Centers. And they're used to doing that. And we're going to assume that they'll continue to doing that, to do that. No reason not to. They're no longer required to have those linkage agreements, but one of the reasons you want to get to know your one-stops is because you want to get access to those job postings and make arrangements with the one-stop system, probably through the Workforce Investment Board, as to how you as an EN can get access to those postings. That's going to be a critical piece of this for 503, I believe. The new rules are specific to include employment networks, state vocational rehabilitation agencies, and American Job Centers in their outreach activities. So that goes to the heart of the first bullet, that even though there's not a linkage agreement required, they are specific that we are referral sources. And this is the first time, I'm pleased to say, that employment networks were actually included specifically with our own section in the rules, and that's pretty exciting. Now, I quoted here from, you want to look at subsection 60-741.44, because this one is important to ENs. It says that the contractor shall take steps to attract individuals with disabilities not currently in the workforce. That was very interesting, and that is related specifically to employment networks. They specifically name us with regard to that in the rules. So again, they're required to do this. We have that as our calling card to say, hey, we've got a lot of people in the ticket program that are not currently in the workforce, as do, of course, the VR agencies as well and the AJCs. But we were actually mentioned particularly as a resource for this particular provision. Now, it also says that they must consider applicants for all available positions, even when the one applied for is unavailable. This is also very, very important, and it specifically is written into the rules that if an individual applies for a position and it's not available to them, they still have to consider them for other jobs that might be available in their workplace. Next slide, please. The rule specifically says that outreach is not effective without internal supervisory and management cooperation. It's that blunt. And so it does say that the contractor must include in their affirmative action policy statement, they must include that statement in their policy manuals, their union notification. They must give that information to all employees and prospective employees, publicize it in company newspapers, magazines, annual reports, conduct special meetings of executive management and supervisory personnel, include it in employee orientation and management training. I think you can see that the rule is very specific, that there's a very, very aggressive outreach requirement that they have. This sort of goes back to that issue of pre-employment offer. Again, they say in the preamble that the reason for that is because they don't have data under the old rules as to whether or not applicants with disabilities are even applying for jobs. That's very telling for outreach. If an employer is not doing effective outreach and not reaching people with disabilities that are qualified, then there's no data to show that if they don't do any kind of pre-offer invitation to disclose. So that in and of itself right there is a good reason for the pre-offer disclosure. Next slide. They are required to do some data collections and That includes the number of applicants who self-identified, the total number of job openings and jobs filled. So you can see what they're looking for there. They want to know, okay, of all of the jobs you've had open, what's the ratio of people with disabilities compared to the total? The total number of applicants for all jobs, and then the number of applicants with disabilities that were hired, and the total number of applicants hired. So the data collection requirements in the rules are very specific, and there's going to be a really strong comparison to see whether or not they're doing effective outreach to encourage people to join their workforce. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, the rules themselves are very specific, but the disclosure issue was of real concern to us, and I wanted to address that. But here's my contact information. If you have any questions on this or you want me to give you some specific information from that preamble, please go ahead and please feel free to give me a call. And now, Darren, I think we can turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you to both Kevin and Susan for today's presentation. And as I mentioned earlier, building upon the information that both Kevin and Susan offer today can certainly help expand your capacity to support federal contractors and become that resource and viable support that can increase positive employment outcomes for individuals and drive your employment network performance. We have a little bit of time now for questions. Frank, if you would please call out for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register for a question, please press the 1-4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. One moment, please, for the first question. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone.
Hi, everyone. This is Felix Stump. While we're waiting for everyone to dial in with questions, there was a particular question. I think everything that came up in the chat was addressed within that tool, but there was a particular question that I thought it was addressed, but I thought maybe for those that weren't in the chat would benefit from hearing it. Kevin, if you're still available, someone asked, Marcella asked during your portion of presentation, why would an AJC that's already operating as an employment network be willing to partner with a private EN since they're a competitor? They kind of would imagine that they might be reluctant to work with them. You gave a great answer already, Kevin, as well as a few other folks, but if you wouldn't mind just briefing, touching on that again.
Sure. Can you hear me, Felix?
Yes.
Okay, great. Good stuff. Well, it's a question that, and I'm getting a little bit of, there we go, I was getting feedback. It's a question that I think deserves more than a couple minutes, but it is a good question. It's a legitimate question, and here's my initial thoughts. You know, Walmart and Kmart, they're competitors. AJCs that are ENs and private ENs, I don't see the same way. We have the same purpose, and you could say that at the private sector too, but I think ours is very different. And you may have skills within your private EN that you can bring to the table that the center does not. In this way, I've seen opportunity for partnerships that have come about in a variety of ways. You know, and that's why I said to Marcel, you're welcome to email me, and I'll spend, you know, some time with you talking about different ways. But, you know, for example, here we had a private EN partner with our job center. The job center was not the EN, so that's a little less confusing. We kind of merged those two ideas, but I do have other examples and have worked with folks who have merged private ENs with job center ENs, and it is a little more tricky, but because of the nature of our work and what we're trying to accomplish, I think it's not quite the same as the private sector out there. We can make this work. So I'm not giving you all the specifics because I think it depends greatly on what goes on, you know, what your center looks like, who you're working with there, what their experience has been operating their EN, and also what you've done as an EN and what you bring to the table. And I think once we can kind of pull those ideas together, I think there's always a middle ground.
Kevin, this is Darren, and to the audience as well. If you keep in mind the overall goal of the Ticket to Work program is to increase economic self-sufficiency of our job seekers with cross disabilities, of our ticket beneficiaries, then we can all work collaboratively and engage in partnership and collaboration that supports the hiring efforts that not only pertain to Section 503, but also increase positive employment outcomes for ticket beneficiaries. So if you keep in mind the general core concept of your employment network, which is to advance the employment opportunities for people with disabilities, I think together in that spirit, working collaboratively, you'll see a positive as to why you should partner and how you should partner. And really, take advantage of the collective resources within your community, because not everybody has the same resources. So you may be asking them for a favor one day, and you may have the ticket beneficiary on your roll, but they may come to you later on and provide you with an asset that you don't have, and that can then advance the ticket beneficiary within your employment network. So just keep that in mind. Frank, are there any questions on the call?
We do have a question from the line of Candy Zarco. Please proceed.
Yes, is there a way to get a list of local federal contractors or that type of information, also like the number of employees, since we're talking about a 7% hiring goal? And I've been on the SAM site, but it's a bit awkward in trying to access that information. I just wonder if there was anything else available.
Rob, if you could please post the next slide. There is a four more information slide that provides some links that you might want to browse and see if that particular question can be answered. I'm not sure if any of our panelists can speak to that, but if they can, I'll pause here for one brief moment.
Susan, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is
ahead.
Susan. Can you hear me? Charlene might address that because we did put together a resource sheet that is posted on the website somewhere. I don't know where it is. I did go and look at it. It's very, very good. And it does address that issue of how to find federal contractors. That was included in the first training.
Yes, and I believe, Susan, that is the link that we're showing now at the Gather Place.
Oh, are you?
Yes,
oh,
we
okay.
are. And it's okay. Visit the Ticket to Work for Service Providers website. But I'm going to say it just for all those people for effective communication. It is https://yourtickettowork.com/web/ticket-to-work/503-resources. And if you would like to email any of the presenters, they will have that link, or myself, and we will provide that. And I know it's a long link, but it is part of the presentation that will be posted online as well. So you'll have multiple ways to access that link. Frank, additional questions?
We have a question from Brenda Venice. Please proceed.
Yes, good afternoon. I was wondering, when federal contractors go out and look for resources or agencies that work with individuals with disabilities, are vocational rehabilitation locations listed anywhere, or is vocational rehabilitation recognized as one of the referral sources?
This is Susan. The answer to that is yes, because they've always had those linkage agreements requirements before the new rules with the voc rehab agencies. I know that here in Arizona, our OSCCP is partnering right now with our state VR agency to do training on the new rules for contractors. So I believe the answer to that is yes, but here's the problem that I see, and that is that ENs are nowhere on their radar screen. So I think they know VR very well, but they don't know us at all. And that's one of the issues that I'm concerned about. We have a tiger team that Bob Williams put together, and Charlene Dwyer chairs that. And we're looking at a rollout strategy of ways to get ourselves in front of those contractors so that they do know who we are. I went to a full-day conference that was held by our Arizona Industry Liaison Group, which is part of the national ILG, and that's the group that all of the EEO affirmative action folks belong to. That, And the entire day, they were presenting just on 503, and ENs were nowhere near to be found, just not even mentioned. So I think our challenge is more getting ENs in front of them than VR at this point. The good news is we are now actually written into the rules, so our name is there. The other thing is that you got an invitation. If you have more than five tickets and have received more than one payment, you did get an invitation from Bob Williams, and there will be more going out if you haven't signed up to get yourself on the ERRD, and oh my goodness, it's the Employer Resource Referral Directory, I believe, and that's how we can get our name actually on there. We did that in a batch format with DOL so that we don't each of us have to do that individually. I did it, and it's not very easy to do. So OESP, which it was called before, has that process in place where you can actually get yourself on that directory if you have more than five tickets and have received one payment, at least one payment.
Thank you, Susan. I was going to ask Charlene to speak to that point about the directory, but I think you covered it. And again, if you have a question on how to get your employment network registered with that directory, please email us and also email within the chat, and we will respond accordingly. Frank, are there any more questions?
There are no further questions at this time.
All right. Thank you very much. Felix, I want to pass the baton back to you for any closing comments. Felix?
Well, I guess, thank you, Darren. I guess all I'd say is that please, I think we've got a few more minutes. I think the call was scheduled to go until 4:30 Eastern. There have been a couple great questions for and about the presentations that you just everyone heard and saw. If there are anyone else, please feel free to press 1, 4, or 14 in order to dial in for questions. They could be about 503. They can be about ENs working with workforce or workforce in general, or it could be about anything really else on the Tickets Work program. And if you have a question for David, he's still here. He's
can
still
I
with
a question?
You can ask. David can ask a question.
Oh, thank excellent. You. Thank you for the great presentation, Susan and Kevin. That was really helpful.
I have one.
Susan?
Yeah.
Susan?
Yeah.
David's got a question for you.
Okay.
So, first of all, thank you for the great presentation. I want to ask a couple of questions. One is, Kevin, you mentioned in your presentation that the America Job Center sometimes has specialists, and you mentioned that they might have specialists that serve veterans. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What would those specialists do if a military veteran sort of walked in the door of an American Job Center?
Right, David, absolutely. Well, you know, our centers have reps generally that work with all customers, but for vets, we, you know, most offices, again, if the office is very small, it may not have, you know, every staff person that I mentioned there, but most offices are going to have veteran reps. And those folks specifically focus on the needs of vets because vets have specific benefits and, you know, backgrounds and needs that, you know, we've found over the years is more adequately served by somebody who understands them best. So vet reps are going to be vets themselves. So they certainly understand where the folks have come from and how to transition them back into civilian life. And, you know, again, often there's disability benefits for vets specifically and a lot of different benefits that they would receive that are not otherwise available to other customers, including some of the tax incentives. So that's why there's a focus on vets. Vets have been a priority for labor also over the years. And so, you know, as I've sat in my seat as, you know, working with folks with disabilities, it sure has made sense that we would also have someone like a disability resource coordinator that works with our customers with those kinds of needs that might be receiving, for example, Social Security and understanding that complex system. So I hope that, in a nutshell, describes who they are and why we have those folks in our office.
Thank you, Kevin. This is Darren, and I can also add a little bit to that. Of course, every workforce development area is different, but normally localized within a one-stop career center, now we're calling American Job Centers, is two positions. One is the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program Specialist, or DVOPS, and there's also a local Veterans Employment Representative, LVER. In addition, if there is a Disability Employment Initiative grant, there's disability resource coordinators. All of these individuals that are located and housed within the American Job Center can be reached through the workforce development agencies. But there is a specific link if you are a veteran and you want to know about your disability veteran outreach program specialist. Then you can go to a specific website and put in your area, and it will locate the American Job Center closest to you or the local Veterans Employment Representative closest to you that you can gain access to and communicate. And unfortunately, we don't have that information on the slide, but if you want to contact me at Darren, D-A-R-R-E-N, last name Bates, B as in boy, A-T-E-S, at Maximus.com, Darren Bates at Maximus.com, I'll be more than happy to provide you the links so you can source out the Disability Veterans Program Specialist. One other thing I want to say about American Job Centers and veterans is that they give priority service to veterans, and that in addition to all the services that the veterans have coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and those platforms, they offer their family and our veterans priority service at all American Job Centers. So there's no waiting, and they can walk in and ask to speak specifically to a veteran rep and get in front of the line. And I think we all appreciate and thank them for their service and would gladly accommodate them. They also have priority access to the job postings that that are within some of the workforce development areas, such as in Texas, there's workintexas.com, and veterans that are that have registered for work using workintexas.com have priority access. In other words, they can see the job postings a couple of days, I believe, prior to the general public.
Well, Darren, thank you very much. And Kevin, one reason I asked this was general interest. We have some of the research we've done just describing our beneficiary population. Social Security, you know, military service has been covered under Social Security since the 50s. So if you look at our roles, there are actually a lot of military veterans on our rolls. There are probably over a million military veterans receiving Social Security disability. So I am kind of interested in all the services that are available for them, even for just because they're Social Security beneficiaries. But that really helps me think about it. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Susan, I guess you had a question for me.
I had a question actually for Darren and for training, Kevin and I talked about this in terms of what this all means to employment networks and working with the AJCs. And a question came up on chat while we were presenting about that, you know, why would we, you know, the whole competitive thing and all that. And really, I think one thing that is really critical is how we get access to those job postings. I did mention it in my presentation, and since we have a couple minutes, Kevin needed to be real general in his presentation because, as has been mentioned several times, there are so many different flavors of one-stops or AJCs, and some are ENs and some are not, and just all over the board. And so it's hard to be very specific about how we as ENs can work with them. And so that's why in Kevin's presentation he talked about next steps and who we should get in contact with and kind of figure out how we can work together if we can. But one of the things that is happening here in Arizona, and I've been trying to get information on how, and you know, I'm sure this is being done in other states as well, but right now as we speak, as of the first of the year, we have through our old MIG, which you know has gone away, but pretty much every state had them, we had websites established for Disability 101, if you will, or DB 101, which came out of the World Institute of Disability originally, and I think a bunch of states have that. Anyway, what they're doing is they're giving us as ENs through that portal access to the American Job Center portal where they have the job exchange so that we will electronically be able to access those job postings, because I'm sure you can understand there's no way that as ENs we're going to get in our car or whatever and go to every AJC and sit there at the bulletin board pulling down jobs. You know, we're just not going to do that. That's not practical to do. But if we can have electronic access to that database, then that would be a really good opportunity for us as ENs to partner with them or at least to use their resources. So that's one thing that I think everybody should really check out with their own one-stops and in their own state. How can you get access to that database and get access to those job postings? That's a biggie for me.
Thank you, Susie. Kevin, I guess, what's your opinion of that? How would the American Job Center view that? Would they be receptive to that, or what's your thought on sort of how even the Department of Labor or others would think about that?
Well, I guess that's why, you know, and Susan, you're right, I had to kind of stay to the general, on the general side of the fence, but I think that, you know, the advice we're trying to give is get to know the center management first and establish that locally, and then get access to the leads. So I think that, you know, it's the same with any partnering arrangement. I think we got to, you know, develop that trust first and what you're trying to accomplish. And you know, when the center understands who you're trying to serve and what you're trying to accomplish, I don't think you'll have any problem with that. And from there, establish the best way to access those leads locally. Because, you know, you're right, Susan, that we'll have leads posted electronically, but if you don't know the business service rep, you know, you're not, and others in our center, you're not going to necessarily, you know, see everything posted, or you might have advantages by knowing those folks, is what I'm saying, in terms of what they know is coming down the pike.
You know, Kevin, Aaron, I really want to highlight what you just said because, and let everyone know, the purpose really is to engage in partnership and collaboration because American Job Centers have resources and connections within their local workforce development area that you may not be aware of. Some are very well connected to the economic development centers, that some are also very well connected to their city and state, and they're aware of large employers coming into the area, particularly federal contractors coming into the area that perhaps are negotiating with the city for tax credits. And the Business Service Unit and American Job Center, connected with economic development centers, the Small Business Association, and the city, can sometimes, if you've developed a really good relationship with your staff at the American Job Center, including your board professionals at the Workforce Development Board level, you can gain access to some very interesting information in advance. For instance, in Texas, we were aware that the Tianjin pipeline to serve, you know, a petroleum chemical multi-billion dollar company was coming into the Coastal Bend area many months, I'd say even a year and a half prior to the actual launch publicly. And so workforce development in that region, along with our employment network, we really targeted that company and showed them what resources that we have to utilize in their hiring efforts, particularly for me at the time when I was a disability navigator, to enroll and hire and retain people with disabilities. So the advantage with partnering with your American Job Center, each one being different, is you can bring to them the resources that you might have. For instance, if you're an independent living center, you can bring some of your core concepts and your peer-to-peer curriculum and your other relationships perhaps with a nonprofit EN such as Goodwill or other nonprofit disability services. And you can join those together with the American Job Center resources, and collaboratively you can harness the collective resources in your community and expand your capacity to serve people with disabilities.
Well, that was what I was trying to get to. I think we tend to focus on agreements, formal agreements and partnerships and who's going to do what part of the job with this particular ticket user, when that's a good idea, and certainly we should be looking at it that way. But what you just said is exactly the thing that I was trying to get to. The AJCs are kind of like a centralized place that contractors are typically used to going to and used to working with because they've been doing it already. And if we can establish that kind of a relationship with the one-stops and have access to those kinds of relationships and resources that you just talked about, I think it'll be much more effective than us banging on doors ourselves. That was kind of the point I was trying to make.
I think that's right on, Susan. Again, this is Darren, and I really also want to think, I say that if you could have a personal relationship, and I think Kevin mentioned this too, and he actually said it very well in his slides about developing partnerships, but any personal relationship you can have and establish can certainly, you know, assist you in your progression with your employment network and your service delivery model. But not only that, you have gained such access to such a diverse and well-articulated scope of resources. So thank you for adding that.
Susan, this is David Weaver again. Did you mention that in some states that have the DB-101 website, they automatically have, EANs automatically can get access to these leads? Or could you, I may not have understood that.
Yeah, you're right, and that's what they're setting that up right now. And I did ask the person that is heading that up, that effort, to find out for me what other states are doing it. And so she's getting that information. And when I get that, I'll definitely get that to you. And we can start there, because I can't imagine that all the states aren't doing this. It seems too organized. It's not something that Arizona would have thought of by ourselves.
I think it's, Susan, this is Felix. I think it's 10 states overall.
Is that right?
I think that's, yeah, the folks putting together EV 101 are, I think, as last I heard anyway, they'd worked with funders to build that in 10 states at that point. It might be more now.
Well, to be the global thinker that I am, though, it seems to me that if the DV 101 can be interfaced with that database, it seems like other databases could link to it too. So it just seems like even if they don't have the DV 101, that there might be some other type of thing similar to it that could feed into that.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's okay. No, I was just going to say I appreciate that you don't want to lose sight of the fact that it's really important to get to know the folks in the one stop to get that cooperation. If you don't have DB 101 or there isn't an effort to give electronic access to that job bank, then that would be definitely something that would be worth going to the Workforce Investment Board in your state about.
Here's a plug for, and I don't know exactly when, and if Charlene's on the call, maybe she can correct me, because I'm probably going to say this wrong, but this is going to lead to a future webinar training that we're going to do on labor market information. For instance, the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, they run direct employers direct providers, which is a way to get labor market information and flag federal contractors for veterans currently. And there's thoughts in the works about moving forward with flagging individuals with disabilities broadly. So there's a U.S. job search engine and other ways for labor market information that you can access electronically. So I probably just confused you, but here's the easy thing. We're going to have a webinar on labor market information in the next month or two that's going to specifically target and help you and advance your knowledge about how to access those leads on an electronic national platform. Is that clear?
Oh, that sounds great. No, that sounds great. Look forward to that.
Great.
So this is Felix. It's been a while since we've checked in with Frank to see if anyone's dialed in with questions. We might have time for one more.
There are no questions at this time.
All right. Then I think I'll go ahead and wrap it up. Thank you very much to Darren, of course. Thank you to Kevin. Thank you, Susan. Thank you to all of you that have dialed in and asked great questions. And the chat was particularly active today. And thanks again, David, for joining us.
Sure, absolutely.
Have a good day, everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. Have a great day, everyone.